Algeria shuts off the internet, Sony gives away the keys to the kingdom, and $1,400 to the Smurfs? All that and more on this week's Longcast. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's Longcast, episode 23, for Tuesday, February 15th, 2011. As always, I'm your host, Kevin Slonka, and here with me today in the studio, Mr. Ryan Lancey.
Hey, how's it going?
I cannot complain. The weather has not been so bad this week.
It's going to get better.
I know, 50s.
50s.
This is awesome.
In Central PA, that's like summer.
That's amazing. Like, yeah. We don't get that.
Nope, not in winter.
Oh, man. So, what's been going on with you recently? Anything interesting happen? Same old crap?
Same old crap, different week.
Yeah, I hear you. I have nothing that interesting going on either. Yeah. So, with nothing interesting going on, the top story of this week is kind of interesting. I'm going to say very interesting. Hot on the heels of Egypt turning off their internet service. Well, let me go back a step. Hot on the heels of Egypt protesting. Every other country in the Middle East is also doing the same types of protests. Everyone. All of them.
Nearly all of them.
All
some.
Of them.
A few. In a couple. Actually, just Iran and Algeria.
All of the world.
Yeah. Like maybe Yemen.
Yeah. Every country. But one country in particular, Algeria, not only decided to shut down their internet service, but they also started deleting Facebook accounts of people who live in Algeria. So, sure, we've seen Egypt shut off the internet before. Big deal. We know countries can do it. But here's what bothers me. That somebody somewhere has power over Facebook to get other people's accounts deleted. How does that happen?
Well, yeah. I haven't thought about it that way.
Yeah,
like you mean like, so somebody has given, in Facebook, has given them power to do this.
Either that or somebody has bowed to the hierarchy of Algeria whenever they say, hey, Facebook, delete all of these people's accounts because they're protesting us. Like, A, Facebook's a U.S. company. Why would you do anything any other country tells you to do? And B, yeah. Why would you go so far as to delete people's accounts?
Unless Facebook in other countries is run by separate entities sort of owned by Facebook USA.
It could be. I never thought of that.
Yeah, that's probably what it is. Because like even like Google in China, like it's a separate, I think it's still like separate entity from Google, but it's like owned by Google.
Yeah, that's, I would love to know, you know, how that actually works. Because if it is still Facebook of the United States who controls everything, like this is ridiculous. And I think it's ridiculous in general, just that countries can, you know, not only shut down the internet, but go delete your private accounts.
Well, that's why they're protesting.
You deleted my Facebook account. I am running out into the street.
I mean, that's it's, you know, the nature of a dictatorship.
Right, right. Yeah, so that was, I don't know what to say
about
that.
What do you think about social media and its power over modern politics now? I mean, to me, these revolutions, like, had, in some way, like, I'm not a big fan of Mark Zuckerberg, you know, on a personal level. Like, you know, I think he's, and like, I don't know, I just have a bad feeling about the guy. But, you know, had he not invented this, and maybe it's the Winklevoss's invention.
The Winklevoss.
They actually were on.
Or the Winklevi.
Yeah, the Winklevi. either way, you know, had these not been invented, like in Twitter, who's the guy who invented Twitter? Evan something?
It was Biz Stone and Ev something.
Yeah, we should know that. We should probably know that.
He's at Ev on Twitter. I don't know his last name.
Yeah, but we still should probably. Anyway, if it weren't for these guys, some of this stuff wouldn't even be possible. Well, they would have tried to revolt, but it wouldn't have been successful. And you know, Evan Williams. Oh, okay, so you know what I mean? Like, it kind of like you can almost attribute some of the success to these new technologies.
No, I totally agree. It's very different to the hippies of the 70s. That when they wanted to, you know, protest our government, they couldn't just go outside and start yelling. They had to drive or walk or ride their bikes to Washington, D.C. and everybody had to gather there and just shout forever or sit in on places. Like,
well, it's more about organizing. Like,
there was no way to organize
it. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, you just, if you thought of something that you wanted to protest, you just went and did it. Maybe nobody else came because you couldn't contact anybody else. You just went and did it. Now, they can be sure that when they show up, there are 20,000 other people who are showing up to do the same thing. And I think it's great. I think it's slightly dangerous, you know, the way that these protests, especially if they're, you know, because all the protests we've seen so far have been pretty much peaceful. Mm-hmm. Like the ones in Egypt, nobody really tried to hurt anybody, though some people did get killed whenever stuff got out of hand. The main point of the protest wasn't to hurt people. It was just people there shouting, we don't believe in this. So that's cool. But I can definitely see it getting out of hand, people, you know, starting to organize murder protests.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, that's something. But I guess, you know, if it wasn't for Twitter or Facebook, MySpace would have been big. If it wasn't for MySpace, there would be some other, like, somebody would have invented something for people to connect.
Well, I'm not trying to attribute too much of the credit to the inventors of those technologies themselves. Maybe I did initially.
I knew exactly what you meant.
Yeah, just the whole fact that this technology exists now. It didn't exist, you know, 10 years ago.
Yeah,
I mean, it had email, I guess.
That's what I was going to say. You know, we had email, so people still had a way to connect, but it wasn't on such a massive scale and such an instant scale. And I think that...
Yeah, because even like Usenet back then, you could publish, you know, you could post to a group, but the servers didn't always pick up those new messages instantly.
Right. Yeah, and you had, you know, you always had IRC, IRC.
Yeah.
But yeah, and I still think that, you know, if it wasn't for the social media as we know it today, there would have been something else. Like, I mean, the only way to not make this happen would have been to not have the internet. Because things just, you know, people find...
It's really access to the internet is what's different now, I guess.
Right.
Like 10 years ago, not as many people had access to the internet as they do now.
Right, and 30, 40 years ago, whenever people really protesting took off, it wasn't even born yet.
Yeah, exactly.
So you had to like write people handwritten letters, hey, come protest with me.
You could like put it in a punch card and mail the punch card
to
them. Ooh,
write it in Fortran. Yeah, I don't even know how protests began back in the 70s. If there's anybody, you know, who protested in the 70s listening, please let us know, because I have no clue how you would have even started this. Maybe somebody saw it on like television, but even that wasn't really national like it is today.
I think it was the ham radio guys.
Oh, it was the hams. I love ham bacon. So anyways, moving on to a story that is very scary / could be cool. And that is, you remember us talking about the Stuxnet virus and how everybody thought this was going to be the worst virus ever. It ended up not hurting anybody's computer, anybody's personal computer, because it was a spy virus that had one target, and that was nuclear reactors in Iran. So the group Anonymous, we talked about them last week, we've talked about them before, the people, you know, supporting WikiLeaks and DDoSing the FBI and other companies who are trying to take them down, they now claim via a Twitter post, Anonymous is now in possession of Stuxnet. Problem, officer? So what do you think about this? You know, the article basically just went on to theorize of, is this good, is this bad? What do you think, Ryan?
I think it's bad, but they said that, you know, the article talks about the fact that being able to reuse the virus may be much more difficult than even is capable. Well, I don't want to dismiss.
Please do not Stuxnet us.
Yes. Do not Stuxnet us.
Please don't. We but do not want to be Stux.
I don't want to get like a Stuxnet and then I walk out in the morning and my car explodes.
Yeah, I don't want to have my net Stuxed.
But I mean, they said it could be very difficult to use because it's such a intricately woven web of code.
And that was pretty much the big thing about this article. The people speaking were like, hey, this virus, points to a specific brand, you know, Siemens control boards in a specific nuclear reactor. So even if they do have it, they can't use it against anybody. But here's how I think about this. Now they have a virus that they have the code to. They can now see how to write a virus, how to hide their tracks. They can see how a virus has to be written to be delivered to machines not connected to the internet. So all they have to do is unravel those couple algorithms, the ways that the code was written, and now they have a virus that they can just change the payload on.
Yeah.
You know, now they can just take out the Siemens control board and replace it with blow up the White House. Or, well, you know what I mean, or whatever they wanted to do.
Yeah.
So I definitely think it can be a very bad thing. Are they bluffing?
I don't know. Well, wasn't there another article, and I don't know if you have this on the list. I don't think you do, but didn't like somebody like find out they say they have the identities of Anonymous?
Well, that was one of the things we talked about last week.
Oh, that's right.
They claimed it, and Anonymous was like, huh, you're wrong.
Oh, well.
Yeah, so.
Okay, never mind.
Yeah, we really don't know what's going to happen
very,
with
very
this.
Very afraid.
Yeah, don't make them mad, because your nets will get stuxed. So I believe you submitted this the next article here.
This is kind of a cool little design doc that I saw on the Chromium Projects website. It's like so everyone knows what the Chrome browser is, and in the development world, they refer to it as Chromium.
So Google's browser.
Yeah, Google's browser. and they have a developer website with, you know, I guess a lot of information about how to, you know, develop if you want to become part of the Chromium project or do other interesting things with Chrome. And the one design document they have is on software updates and how to how they deliver software updates for Chrome using some interesting differential algorithms. So everyone, you know, when you get you know what it's like, you know, you get a new version of Firefox, you got to go download like a 35 meg file.
That's what I was just going to say. This is something that people who use Firefox probably don't know about because you don't get differential updates for Firefox.
Yeah,
you have to download a new program.
Maybe I should give you a little background actually. So I've been using Chrome for, you know, it was pretty much since version like 2 or 3. And the really interesting thing about it is when you go to get it'll look for updates, but if you go to the about page, like if you go help about, you know, inside the application, it'll look for updates right then when you do that, and it typically will patch itself almost without asking you. It's just like, boom, we're grabbing the new updates for you, and it takes like no time at all to do. And then it's like, hey, Chrome's got to restarts, boom, new version. Like it takes like seconds to do typically, and we're talking like from like version 7 to version 8, like a big upgrade, like not like, oh, it's 8.1 and we're going to 8.1.2.3.5.4.
And that's crazy that it takes seconds.
Yeah, it seems like seconds. It's just, it's really fast. And you've got a brand new version. Well, here's how they do it. So there's a utility called bsdiff that basically takes an executable and the new version of the executable, and it does a binary diff or some kind of low-level diff between the two files, and it figures out a way to like describe a file or make a file that describes the differences, and then you just deliver the update as the difference with like an executable to like patch the old executable with this diff file.
So that's something that a lot of Unix people probably know, you know, diff files on text. It just shows you what's changed.
Yeah, this is a little bit different with doing it on the binary at a binary level versus like word-to-word comparison,
right,
or letter-letter comparison. I mean, it's all done in binary eventually, but you know, you get the point.
One's a nose,
right? One. So anyway, Google or the developers for Chrome have taken it a step further, and they have this new technique called I think you pronounce it Courget. It's Courgette. Courget is how I would say it.
I first thought it was like Cougarette, and I'm like, oh, they're finding a way to meet older women.
Cougarette. We won't get into that. Anyway, so Courget or Courget, however you say this, it's this different algorithm that uses, first it uses a disassembler to take the executable and disassemble it back into assembly code. And then it does a diff on the assembly code because typically the changes at the assembly code level are much less, they're more verbose because you're working with assembly code, but the changes are less, there's just less change. Like in a binary file, you change one thing and then it like could totally render the executable different.
Well, for those people who don't know the difference between assembly code and like standard C code, could you just give a quick...
Okay, so assembly code is basically human, it's basically human readable machine code. And machine code is sort of a hexadecimal version of the commands and data that are actually loaded into the CPU. So that's, you know, the CPU actually understands machine code. And like a command might be like move, and the hexadecimal for that might be like, you know, in hexadecimal might be like 3B or something. So you, the word might be like 3B10, and that means load 10 or move one memory location 10 or something like that.
So it's kind of a way, assembly is more of a way of saying, you know, take this data, put it in this slot.
Right.
Take this operation like addition, put it in this slot. Use those two together and put that result in this slot.
Right.
So it's like, and one slot at a time.
Yeah, and the assembly is just a little more human readable. Instead of the instead of you looking at a code like I said, like 3B10, you would actually see like move, like the command move, then like
courgette.
Oh, is that how you say it?
Courgette.
Courgette.
Courgette. I think that's the French.
It's French for zucchini.
I don't know if that's what they meant to call it or not.
This is the zucchini update.
It's the zucchini update. So anyway, you know, so you have this move command, and by doing, by disassembling the executable, I've gotten way off track, but disassembling the executable and comparing it at the at the assembler level, you can get these like almost text comparisons between the two executables. And then they turn that into this courgette differential.
And that basically means smaller
yeah,
differential
very
files.
Very small. Like, so a full update, like to totally download the new version of Chrome, 10 megabytes. To do a BS diff, 700K. To do a courgette update, courgette update is only 78K. So it's two orders of magnitude less than the full update.
Yeah, and to put that in perspective for people, if you have even the slowest DSL or the slowest cable modem, that's like a second, maybe 2 seconds to download that update file.
Yeah, like even the BS diff is going to be about 10 to 15 seconds. So
right.
So not only can it download the payload very quickly, then it's got this very little file. It just has to do the reverse of the diff, which is the courgette like patch command or whatever. It patches the executable or whatever DLL files it uses, and then, you know, closes the application, starts back up, bam, you got a new version.
Courgette.
It's awesome. I think it's really cool.
So here is my question. Do you think Google will open source this? Because Chromium is technically the open source code of Chrome. So do you think this courgette operation will be open sourced in such a way that other companies, Microsoft, Mozilla, every other manufacturer can take it and use it in their own?
Maybe. They said they're writing a more detailed paper and they're going to post it when it's ready. So I'm going to look for that. I've dealt with deploying applications, and sometimes the packaging and repackaging of the updates and then handling all the error conditions would be a lot easier than just like basically patch the executable, you know.
Right.
You know, and in your little update, your update utility, you can do a quick check and say, oh, is it the right version? Is it, you know, you do an MD5 on it or something, make sure it hasn't been already modified by something else.
Yeah, this is very interesting. I mean, just seeing the hard numbers, you know, a 10 megabyte download for the browser, a normal 704K update, and then a 78K update. I mean, this is great because, you know, like we mentioned earlier, for people who run Firefox, you don't even have differential updates. Whenever there's a patch, they just say, hey, go download the new version, and you have to download a new 9 meg download.
Yep.
So this is definitely awesome. You know, plus one to Google and Chrome for being able to do this. And while we're talking about Google, a new feature that is slowly being rolled out, I don't want to say it's out there for everybody because I still don't see it, but Google is now adding two-factor authentication for your Gmail email account. So what does that mean? Well, normally you log into your email, you need username and password. That can be stolen by people. So Google realized this, and they added a way that you can enable to add a second factor of authentication, which in this case is a text message to your cell phone. So Google has probably already asked you, if you have a Gmail account, to register your cell phone. In the case that you would lose your account, this is how they would verify that you are you. So if you haven't given your cell phone to Google yet, this is one of those rare times where I'm going to say go do it. Because if for some reason somebody hacks your Gmail or any other Google account, or you just happen to forget your password, Google will use your cell phone to verify you are you to give you access to your account back. So now they're using that for two-factor authentication. So if you enable this, you log in with your username and password. It sends you a text message. and you have to type in the verification code that came in the text message, and then you are logged into Gmail. Help or hindrance?
I think it's pretty cool. I mean, you know, anything for security, right? You know, at least you have the option to turn it on or off. I like that.
Right. Yeah. I personally think it is awesome. However, for me, it is a hindrance. I saw one of my Twitter followers, or I was following him. I think we follow each other. But he posted this article, and I immediately replied him. I'm like, this is awesome. I'm not going to use it. The last thing I want to do when I log into my Gmail account is get my phone involved every time. Like, I mean, would you actually turn this on and have to have your cell phone with you just to be able to get your email?
I mean, it's almost always beside me, you know, well, most of the time, except at work. So, yeah, I think it'd be okay. Or, you know, they added some extra functionality to it. Like, maybe, you know, once you log in, it stays logged in for a couple hours.
And that is, it's something like 15 or 30 minutes.
Yeah, that'd be pretty cool.
But something that, you know, I wanted to talk about that. That kind of defeats the whole purpose, because they're not saying that you stay logged in for 15 or 30 minutes. They're saying that the verification code they sent to your phone remains active for that long. So once you input that verification code to log into Gmail, as far as Gmail servers are concerned, you are authenticated. So any further attempts to authenticate are only username and password. So by leaving that on, you are opening yourself up to the same attack you were always open for those 15 or 30 minutes.
Yeah, but I mean, there's still a reduced window of opportunity.
There definitely is.
You know, yeah. If you think of it in terms of a day, you've got, you know, 1/48th of a day or something.
Right, and I think, you know, we should compare this by default, where on my machines at home, I shouldn't say this, but I never log out of my Gmail account. Mm-hmm. So every time I open up Gmail, I'm just instantly in. Mm. And, you know, the cookie does that. When the cookie expires, it'll log me out. But I don't think Gmail's cookies expire. Because I am never logged out of Gmail. Like day after day after week, I open up a tab, go to Gmail, I am instantly logged in and don't have to type in my credentials.
Are you sure your browser doesn't have the password saved?
I turn that off. Huh. My browsers do not save passwords.
That's interesting.
Yeah, so it's like on Facebook too. You know, some websites just keep your cookies active for way too long.
When I heard they were going to have this two-factor security, I thought it was going to be kind of like the Holy Grail when he comes up to the... was it the knight? And he says, "What is your name? What is your quest? What is your favorite color?"
Me.
Anyway.
Yeah. So that is cool. So if you were worried about people getting into your Gmail account, look in the next couple days, maybe the next couple weeks. And this is not in your Gmail settings. If you're into Gmail, you will have to go to settings and then scroll down to the bottom and open up your Google account settings. So the option to turn it on will be in your Google settings, not your Gmail settings. Hmm. But to keep talking about Google, how would you feel if Google went off the internet? I would feel pretty bad.
Me too.
Because I use Google all the time.
Yeah.
But that is exactly what the MPAA is threatening to do. And basically, Google not only is a search engine, but they are also an internet service provider for certain areas, certain people.
For themselves.
Well, yeah, for themselves too. But other non-Google employees also use them as their internet service provider, depending on where you live. And the MPAA happened to see, you know, torrents being copied over their internet service of, you know, movies, The Fighter, The Green Hornet. And basically, Paramount, Columbia, you know, spoke to the MPAA, and the MPAA is like, hey, Google, we will shut you off the internet if you allow this piracy to take place over your lines. So what do you think about this? I think it's a bluff, because I've never seen the MPAA shut off an entire ISP.
Well, for part of it would be shutting, you know, that'd be unlikely. But also, they'd almost be like shooting themselves in the foot. How would anybody find out about Paramount or Columbia Pictures on the, you know, like they would, I guess they could use Bing. I guess this is a perfect example of why we should have two search engines.
So I'm going to call it right now. Microsoft is behind the MPAA.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
They're all the way up in Redmond.
No, I mean, that's a good idea, because, you know, despite Bing being good and a lot of people using it, Google still seems to be the number one search engine. So if they were to shut them off, there goes 50%, maybe more, of internet search traffic that would take people to Paramount or Columbia Productions.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they are kind of, they would be losing money if they did this.
Yeah, because if I want to find out about a movie or where to go see a movie, I'm going to use Google, you know, to probably find movie listings. So I think if they're seriously considering this, that they should seriously reconsider this.
Yeah, this, I mean, the MPAA, the RIAA, they always do very stupid things, and this just seems like another one in the long list of stupid things that they do. Mm-hmm. So, man, we have a lot of Google stories now, but this one is also a face more of a Facebook story. So we've talked a couple weeks ago about how Google makes their money. They're an advertising company. You know, that's pretty much 99% of their revenue is through ads. And people who make Facebook apps can put Google ads in their Facebook application. So in a sense, you're using Facebook. Not only do you get the Facebook ads on the right-hand side, but if you're running an app inside of Facebook, you can also see Google ads, text ads, probably Google AdSense, the text ads. But Facebook is now denying that. Not now, in a couple weeks, they will start. But they will not be allowing Facebook application designers to use Google ads in their Facebook applications. I think this is going to be a fighting match here.
Well, isn't this similar to what happened on the iPhone? Like, didn't the you know, when they started to, some new terms came out like maybe a year ago with...
Whenever they went to the in-app, I forget how they call them, but the in-app ads, the little ad bars at the bottom of the application.
They changed some things.
They changed advertising companies, where the ads came from.
Right, and then there was also some language in there that, like, the ads couldn't use Google's ad service.
Yeah, it was weird the way they said it. They didn't specifically say that, but the progression that they made, it's like, I can't use this, that also uses this, while at the same time using this, but that really meant you can't use Google.
Right, yeah. So, I mean, it's, I mean, this is, I'd say, hey, it's within Facebook's rights to determine what's in their software, right?
It is, and I think we're seeing now Facebook turning to, quote-unquote, make money.
Yeah.
You know, for the longest time, they were just, oh, this cool place you could go. And now it's like, no, we're also an ad company. We have our own ads.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they've got to already be making. There's a lot of ads that pop up, you know, on the sides now.
Yeah. I know they're making a lot of money. Yeah. But I think,
and I have, you know, I have seen some of those personalized ads.
Have you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can't remember who, but it's like so-and-so likes something or other. I can't remember.
Yeah. This person likes this. Maybe you should too.
Yeah.
Or this person checked into Starbucks. Have you gone to Starbucks lately? Yeah, so this is why I always tell people, whenever you're on websites, don't click the Facebook like button. Why would you do that? And don't use Facebook places to check into places. You know, you're just giving out your personal information. But this didn't turn into a big deal whenever Apple got rid of Google Ads for their own ad platform. I don't know whether it's going to turn into a big deal with Facebook doing the same thing. Because really, I mean, let's be honest, you lose the iPhone, you lose Facebook, there goes 99% of the internet population. You know, like the two places, you know, the iPhone is the most popular smartphone, Facebook is the most popular website. Like, you've just lost most of the internet looking at your ads if Facebook drops you.
Yeah, it's definitely a pretty big source of them. But I mean, I think still Google has a lot of traffic on their own merit. Just people go to Google to search things. I do know a lot of people using Facebook to search for things. Like, they'll just type things in the Facebook bar and then click the links that come up. Like, there's web, you know, because it has a web search utility built
via
in.
Via Bing, I believe.
Yeah, which was smart for Bing.
And that's probably another reason why they're dropping Google ads, because Facebook partnered with Bing and Microsoft's probably like, hey, uh-uh.
Yeah, good point.
Yes. Yeah, so whenever you see those people who use Facebook to search for stuff, give them a punch in the jaw for me, because that is just stupid. So anyways, let's get away from Google and let's talk about Microsoft.
All right. So this one's mine. Sorry.
Yeah, it's your story.
Oh, whoops. It was like a segue without a segue. But so really big news, I think. Microsoft has released the release candidate for Internet Explorer 9.
Oh, it's not... It's not final yet?
No, release candidate. Well, it's supposed to be final, I think, it's probably, what's this, Service Pack 1, maybe?
Oh, it says April 12th.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so April 12th. And There's something that's coming out, though, that it's going to release with, I thought.
Our next article talks about Windows 7 and Server SP1.
Is that what it was? Okay. So anyway, it's out, release candidate. I don't know if you checked out the beta. The beta...
I have not.
You have not. I really think if, you know, if you have a Windows machine, which you don't...
I do at work, but at my house, I do not.
Yeah. It's worth a look. I grabbed it as soon as I heard about the release candidate. You know, being published, and they fixed a lot of bugs from the beta. There was some, at least with my hardware or video hardware, there were some issues with the graphics acceleration, the hardware acceleration that's built into the browser.
What does that do in terms of the browser? Is that just for like flash playback, or does the Chrome of the browser?
I think the Chrome of the browser. Well, I don't even know that maybe the Chrome is. At least in Windows 7, that's all. The whole desktop window manager is
handled by Windows,
right? Or handled by the graphics hardware. So that may not be true of that specifically of Internet Explorer 9. But on web pages that use like, you know, heavy duty graphics, they've got a hardware acceleration layer in there in the browser, which is the only now it's the only browser in the world that has that, from what I've read. Which is pretty impressive. They have a website you can go check out. It's called beautyoftheweb.com. And when you go there, there's some things you can turn on and check out the features of it. And like you can run it side by side in Chrome. And I mean, I love Chrome, but it's unbearable to even try to use in Chrome. It's so slow. But
I'm trying right now in Firefox on my Linux machine. I hope my browser doesn't crash.
Yeah. Turn on the... there's like the fish, the aquarium. There's a sidebar there somewhere, and you can turn on the aquarium.
Oh, I don't think it lets me. It's forcing me to download IE9.
Well, if you have something, are you using Chrome, you said?
No, Firefox.
Is Firefox HTML5 compatible?
Should be. I've used HTML5 things before, like the canvas tag and stuff.
Yeah, it might use some other specific things that only, maybe Chrome or Safari is the only other things that supports it, but... while those browsers support those features, they don't accelerate them, so they're very slow. But anyway, it has other cool features, like you can pin websites right to your taskbar. So if you go to like Facebook and you say pin to your taskbar, you get a little icon on your that sticks on your taskbar, and then you can click it and it goes right to Facebook, you know, and it saves your session and all that stuff. It's really cool. I like it. It's still not bug free. There's still some issues, some scrolling issues, some font issues. In my opinion, that things don't look quite right. But all in all, it's really fast. It zips around real quick. And
in this list, we're looking at an article from TechSpot.com. There's a list of the additions just between the beta and the RC, and there's a lot of stuff in that list.
Yeah, it's like they have like four columns of stuff and probably about, you know, I'd say an average of like 10 to 15 items in each column or something. Well, the one only has about three, but the other three are pretty filled.
Yeah, so this definitely, if they keep this up, because normally companies will go from beta to RC, and depending on the bugs that they have, they might go RC1, RC2, RC3, and then final. So we could still see possibly up to three more revisions before the final release. But if they keep up, you know, adding features and fixing bugs, this looks like it's going to be a pretty decent browser.
Yeah. So it's free. You can go check it out. It's the one note, if you do download and you don't like it, to remove it, it's a little bit tricky. It's not listed in the installed programs in Windows 7 or Vista or wherever. It's listed in the updates. So you have to go to the Windows updates page and remove that update. It still cleans out just like a program, but...
they just hide it a little bit.
Yeah, well, I think because it's a component of Windows, it's handled a little differently.
Yeah. Yeah, so keeping on that same track, our next article talks about the Service Pack 1 that is coming out for Windows 7 and Server 2008 R2. Now, we did mention just a couple seconds ago that we thought IE9 might be coming out at the same time, but IE9 is slated for an April release date, while Service Pack 1 is slated for next week.
Yeah,
February 22nd. But it doesn't look like it's going to be a big deal.
Yeah, we talked about what it would mean for Windows 7 users a couple weeks ago. I think Paul Thurrott had an entry in his blog about it on the Win Super site.
Yeah,
Super
and even Windows. He said it's whatever. Yeah.
It's just basically a roll-up of all your hot fixes and security updates over the last, 18 months or however long it's been out.
Yeah, so the only difference now is we have a date. February 22nd
yep.
is when this is supposed to come out. So for those of you, I always say whenever a service pack comes out, wait a couple weeks, see what the internet has to say. Were you the one saying, Ryan, that you normally get it like the day it comes out?
I'll usually seek them out. Maybe not the day it comes out, but as soon as I have time, that I know that if my machine were to
you would have time to fix it.
Yeah, if it was going to grenade my machine.
Yeah, so it seems like we both generally have the same feeling toward, a service pack or big updates. It might break.
Yeah, I mean, not even because there's a problem with the update itself, just in the process of you updating, something happens to your hard drive and totally hoses it.
So our next article is from the Voloch conspiracy.
Voloch.
Voloch.
I think that's like Klingon.
Is it Hebrew?
No, it's Klingon.
Oh.
I don't know.
I don't know Klingon. What are you talking about? Court holds that data about car speed and brake usage stored in the car's computer protected by the Fourth Amendment. And
What's the Fourth Amendment? Quick.
Government access to your stuff.
Unlawful search and seizure, right?
Something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't know the exact words, so I didn't want to say something that was totally stupid. Okay, so Ryan's probably going to look up the exact words for the Fourth Amendment. But basically saying that, here is a quote from the opinion article. We do not accept the Attorney General's argument that defendant had no reasonable expectation of privacy in the data contained in his vehicle's SDM. Which they don't define what SDM is in this article, but let's just say that's the car's computer. So let's see. The precision data was generated by his own vehicle. While you're driving on public roads and you are observable, that data is exposed to public view or being conveyed to anyone else. So what do you think about this?
Well, I think someone else, I don't know if it was this article or another, but they gave the analogy that, when you buy a computer, you own the software in the computer, you don't own the software in the computer, but that software generates data from you using it, so you own that data, because it's generated by you, and it's not expected to be publicly available. You do have the expectation of some privacy to that data, so I think you could. I think that argument stands for, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have much to say about this.
Yeah.
I agree with
it. I think it's
it.
Cool, yeah.
Yeah.
That they protected the Fourth Amendment.
Yeah. I wish we had, a lawyer here who could, argue with us and tell us we're wrong and totally rip this apart.
Well, they'd be wrong if they did that.
Yes.
So, the Fourth Amendment is this, because I always like to, history and stuff. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized.
Very long.
Yeah. Well, I think in the digital age, there's a lot of, we covered a story about, why you should encrypt your phone. Was that?
Yeah.
Good reasons to encrypt your phone. Not that you should be doing anything illegal, but, if there were something you did by accident and didn't realize you broke a law,
visited WikiLeaks and now you're going to get fired from your job.
Right. Well, yeah.
On accident.
Yeah. But anything that you don't want other people to immediately have access to, is good. It's good to encrypt it, and I think these search and seizure laws are going to become very, on the forefront of political controversy with respect to digital media and.
Yeah, and I think the amendments in general are going to have to people are going to start taking closer looks at them just because of the digital medium.
Mm-hmm.
Everything doesn't really apply the way it did when these amendments, when the Constitution, when the Declaration were written.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it definitely takes some new.
There needs to be an interpretation to apply it to the modern world.
Right, yeah. Right. Somebody needs to take a look at that. So while we're going through government-style stories, we have one about the FCC, and it's not about net neutrality, thankfully. This one is about GPS jamming, which is basically, you know, approved by the FCC now.
Well, they didn't approve jamming.
Right, they did not approve jamming. But what they did do, let me just read a quote from the article. On January 26th, the FCC waived its own rules and granted permission for the potential interferer to broadcast in the L-band 1, which is 1525 to 1559, from powerful land-based transmitters. This band lies adjacent to the GPS band, 1559 to 1610, where GPS and other satellite-based radio navigation systems operate. So what they've done is they have given this company ability to broadcast on a range that is right up against the same range that GPS uses. Now, you might think, what's the big deal? You know, L-band 1 ends at 1559, GPS picks up at 1559. No problem. Well, there is problem because there's bleed over, and they did some tests with a couple GPS units to see just what the problem was. So this tower, they drove around the tower that is spitting out data in the L-band 1, the jamming signal, per se. And with the Garmin Nuvi 265W, jamming was detected once you got within 3.5 miles. They lost service in the Urban Canyon at 1.7 miles, and they totally lost the fix. The fix is what they call, you know, total loss of signal. So the fix is the GPS signal. So total loss of GPS at a little over a half mile away. So that was for the Garmin Nuvi, but for the GNS 430W, jamming was detected at almost 14 miles. They lost sensitivity at a little less than 10 miles, and they totally lost the fix at 5.5 miles. So these tests have pretty much proved that the FCC kind of made a boo-boo, and it is very possible for people's GPSs, and not only people's, aircraft, anything who uses GPS around these cell towers, they could lose it.
Yeah.
So have you run into GPS problems like this? Something that you might thought have been jamming or interference?
The only time that I've had a lot of problems with GPS is in dense urban environments where the buildings are really tall.
So pretty much line of sight that you don't have.
Yeah, those are definitely challenging, especially if you don't already have a fix. It has to get a fix.
Right.
It seems like sometimes if you already have it, it can like keep it, but... nothing that I would consider to be jamming, but yeah, I was just reading the article here on GPS on Wikipedia that it's 1575, I guess, is the center frequency for the main band for GPS. Yeah, I mean, you have to be. That's why spectrum management was started. Like, you know, this is a lot of people wonder, well, why can't they just add more cell phone towers? But This is why there's spectrum management, because there's services that we depend on, like you know, police radios, 911, and you know, all those different first responder services, GPS, military radios, all that stuff. It has to all coexist. So, you know, way back in the day when radio stations started to, you know, flourish, that's one of the reasons they founded the FCC. So they sort of like dropped their like core purpose.
Yeah.
They've dropped the ball on that.
Yeah, and the funny thing is, you know, the company that requested to be able to broadcast in the spectrum up against the GPS spectrum is a company called Light Squared, and they are basically a wireless internet provider. You know, they're from their website, they will unleash the boundless opportunity of wireless broadband connectivity for all. So, I mean, there are a lot of wireless internet service providers out there. There's a Clearwire, you know, they do WiMAX. There's a couple other WiMAX services. Light Squared is building a 4G, so an LTE wireless broadband internet service provider. And so this is interesting, because if LTE is taking up this spectrum, how is this going to work with mobile phones? You know, I don't necessarily know the spectrum range that LTE works with mobile phones, but if it is the same or close to the same as what this company is using for their mobile internet, which I assume it might be, because, you know, technically cell traffic is internet traffic, I'm wondering if, you know, LTE networks like Verizon or whoever starts putting it up is also going to interfere with GPS.
Well, I think right now LTE's supposed to be in like the 700 megahertz band, which is what they auctioned off. But it also supports other bands. Obviously, I think, you know, the cell phone companies own little sections of bandwidth, and if they wanted to like replace their 3G with LTE, they could.
Right.
So, you know, as like 3G or older devices, you know, start to fall off.
Yeah, so it seems like this is one of the optional LTE bands that this mobile internet provider decided to use.
And yeah, I don't know. I don't see any listings for, you know, for 1400 specifically. I know in the United States right now that's not used for any current cell phone carriers. Like, I think Verizon uses something like, I want to say 2100.
Yeah, there's like 800 and 900, and then there's 21 and or 2000, or maybe it's 21 and 22.
Yeah, and then I think T-Mobile's like the weird one. It's like 1700.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I don't think there's anything in that band right now. So, anyway.
Yeah, so, yeah, we'll see what happens if that company gets shut down when the FCC realizes it's boo-boo.
Oh, here we go. Here's the planned deployments for LTE are 700, 900, 1800, 2600. And then... Oh, I'm sorry. 700 only in America. Then 900, 1800, 2600 in Europe, 1800 and 2600 in Asia, and 1800 in Australia.
Okay, so either way, assuming that GPS is the same frequency in all countries, LTE cell phones aren't going to touch them.
Yeah, I think GPS is the same everywhere.
Yeah, so that's so that won't be a problem.
Yeah.
So I just brought that up for no apparent reason. So let's move on. Our next story is kind of a sad story. I feel like I should be playing, you know, the day the music died. Guitar Hero is no more. Do you play Guitar Hero? Have you played?
I have. I like Rock Band more because you can sing.
The new version of Guitar Hero, you know, basically tried to mimic Rock Band. They added singing. They added drums.
I mean, it was all the same company, right?
I don't believe.
Oh, I thought the... Because you can use your Rock Band guitars.
Activision made a Guitar Hero. Let's do a quick look up and see who makes Rock Band. But I do not believe that they are the same company. I am doing a search and scrolling.
I'm searching in Facebook.
Harmonix makes Rock Band. Activision makes Guitar Hero.
That's weird, though, because the guitars are compatible.
It's they're just Bluetooth. So, I mean...
Well, no, I mean, like, way back even on... I'm trying to remember what I used to play it on. I think Xbox 360 or the original Xbox. I don't remember what it was.
Yeah, I don't know.
I've been PlayStation.
I've only ever played a Rock Band on a PS3, so I've never tried to use my stuff on any other system.
Yeah, I know at one time, at least, that a friend of mine had... I mean, they're the exact same guitars, and they plug in, you know, like... Maybe they cross-license the controller technology. Well, actually, the controller technology is the same. It's got to be based on whatever the controller setup. They probably just have the buttons mapped a certain way.
Well, I mean, the controller technology isn't the same because the Xbox controller is nowhere close to the PS3 controller. So, you know, like you said, you need to map the buttons on the guitar to the buttons on a real controller, and those aren't the same.
Yeah, but I think the ones that I saw weren't wireless. The guitars that I've used in the past weren't wireless.
Okay.
But my point is that my friend owned Guitar Hero, then bought Rock Band, and I think he was able to use one of the guitars for like the bass on Rock Band.
That's interesting.
I thought.
Well, not anymore because he's not going to have any newer Guitar Hero
right,
guitars.
Yeah. Oh, well.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is... I kind of think it's sad, but I also think, you know, this is long overdue. Guitar Hero kind of turned into one of those games where they realized they had a hit, so they just tried to put out edition after edition. It's like, you know, here's Guitar Hero. Here's Guitar Hero 2. Here's Guitar Hero 3. Here's Guitar Hero Aerosmith. Here's Guitar Hero Metallica. Here's Guitar Hero Slongcast. Like, really. You know, they put out an edition of Guitar Hero for every band that's out there, and it just kind of got overplayed. So I guess they realize that now. And no more Guitar Hero. This is... the last one, they have discontinued development for 2011. So.
Oh, okay. Wait. Guitar Hero was developed by Harmonix, 2005 to 2007. They must have.
And then
sold,
they sold to Activision.
They must have sold it to Activision. No, Activision's just the publisher. The developers are Harmonix, at least from 2005 to 2007. Then Neversoft, and then Vicarious Visions. Red Octane was the publisher 2005 to 2009, as well as Activision 2006 to 2011, and. I was just on Rock Page or Rock Band.
Rock Page.
Okay, publisher for that is MTV Games. So the publishers are different, but okay. it was the same developer. Anyway, so that's probably why it was compatible.
Yeah. Yeah, very interesting. But I guess now you're just gonna have to play Rock Band. You know, I haven't heard anything about Rock Band being discontinued. Maybe it already has and I'm just not up on the times. But forget about Guitar Hero now. And our last story that has to deal with gaming consoles, we've talked before, you know, many weeks about Geohot and his jailbreaking of the PS3. Well, this one dude, not George Hotz, posted the hexadecimal key for the jailbreak to the Kevin Butler on Twitter, which is Kevin Butler, the person from Sony. I don't realize his actual...
But it's fictional, though, right?
What?
Well, it says here, on the article from Engadget, it said, Sony PlayStation's entirely fictional Kevin Butler holds many also fictional positions within the company. So this guy's not really worked... He doesn't really work for them, does he?
See, I don't... Well, yeah, Kevin Butler is the dude from the commercials.
Oh...
But I'm pretty sure that account is run by someone at Sony.
Oh.
That's what the internet is saying, at least.
Okay.
Yes, Kevin Butler, the blonde-haired guy from the PlayStation commercials, is not a real person.
Okay. Yeah. I didn't know that. I don't think I've seen the commercials.
Well, if you look real close at the icon,
yeah,
it looks like you can see that's the same dude.
Okay.
But either way, this supposedly Sony employee retweeted the hexadecimal key for the jailbreak out to the rest of the world, and it looks like because he didn't know what it meant. So his comment on there after the dude tweeted to him and he retweeted was, let me guess, you sank my battleship? Because if you kind of look at it, it kind of looks like the code you would give somebody when you're playing Battleship. You know, B3, C4. But really, you know, as far as the internet says, Sony or somebody from Sony just retweeted out the jailbreak code. And this is akin to back whenever HD DVD, you know, got hacked and everybody was posting the hex code for HD DVD, the root key, all over the internet. So kind of a funny thing. And yeah, like you said, it may or may not be true. We don't know. You're waving. Why are you waving?
Oh, no reason.
this is kind of weird for those of you who can't see. Ryan just waved to his screen. And I think he's losing it. So our next story. Someone died because of a text message.
Well, that's not cool.
It was only a matter of time. So apparently these two British dudes, I don't know what the word for dude is in Great Britain, or is it England or the UK?
I don't know. Well, there's that really cool video that shows you the
There is the really cool video. But either way, he went and sent in a text message, and his text message contained the word Nutter, N-U-T-T-E-R. But because of the predicted text, it was actually spelled Mutter, M-U-T-T-E-R. Now, I don't know what the context was, like why this made them fight so much, but they like literally started fighting with each other in person.
Well, in text first, right?
Oh, yes, in text first. Yeah. And it got so heated that they fought with each other in person. And then all of a sudden, bam, they're grabbing knives and stabbing.
Yeah.
I mean, have you ever... Okay, so everyone has run into this problem before. Because of something stupid in a text message, your phone predicts the wrong word or whatever, somebody gets mad on the other end.
Yeah.
It's happened to everyone. Has it ever gotten so heated with you that you're like, whoa?
No, I mean, I've never had a heated discussion through text messages, really. Although people, like, sometimes it gets you get angry because it's like you're trying to convey a point and it's like they don't understand it because you can't get it across in 160 characters.
Either that or you can't get your tone across or something that text just can't do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it has happened. Somebody has died from a text message. So we talked about cell phones a little bit before, and specifically LTE. And this one article from GigaOhm lists 10 things that you might need to know about the next generation of LTE. The LTE, which would actually be 4G, as the, what's that group? It's the I-something.
I don't know.
Whatever group puts out the standards of what 3G means, what 4G means.
Oh. The ITT? No, ITNT? ITU.
ITU.
That's the ITU. The International, like...
Technology...
No, like Telephone Standards
Unit.
Organization.
I don't know. So either way, whatever that group is, they define 4G. The LTE that Verizon and all the other companies are putting out now is not 4G. It's not fast enough to be 4G.
Exactly.
LTE Advanced will be fast enough. It will actually be 4G. And I'm not going to read all 10 points, but there are a couple things, such as on the uplink side, you can get up to 200 megabits for an uplink. That's pretty awesome. Multiple input, multiple output to also boost capacity via multiple antennas on your machine. Did you see anything in here that specifically caught you?
Not really. I mean, the advanced, you know, the higher speeds is pretty cool. I mean, it's expected, you know, we're going to see some enhancements just like we did with high speed downlink packet access, HSDPA or whatever it is.
Yeah, I think this is kind of funny in a way that, you know, we're already, LTE Advanced is already, you know, a standard. It's already out there. People are talking about it, and we don't even have LTE phones yet. So it's kind of interesting. I think Ryan is Skyping somebody while we're doing the Slongcast.
Maybe.
If we only had multiple audio cables, we could get this person in on the show, but I do not have extra audio cables to plug them in.
No.
So let's just move on to an article from CNET that HTC is investing $40 million into OnLive. Have you heard of OnLive before?
No, I had not.
So OnLive is a company that provides streaming services such as video games to mobile devices. That's one of the things they do. So people were able to demonstrate, you know, playing a 3D awesome video game on an iPad via the OnLive service. And the mobile phone company HTC is investing $40 million in this service. So what do you think about this? You see HTC being not only a phone company, but trying to move into the mobile game market now?
You know, what I find interesting is that they would even think they'd have a shot. Like, I mean, I know, like, I think Android has a shot at, like, at the, you know, smartphone market. But in terms of gaming, like, there's just, there's like no way. I just don't see it happening.
Well, okay, so you don't think they have a shot. Why don't you think they have a shot? Is there somebody else out there who is just so much better?
Well, I think Apple has definitely shown themselves to be a huge gaming platform, like mobile gaming.
That's kind of what they're going for too, you know, especially in their iPod Touch series.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they say that that's an awesome gaming platform, and if you've seen the games that run on it, they're really good.
Yeah, there's definitely some, you know, really cool games that have come out on, you know, and I think the three-dimensional sensors, the what are they called?
The gyro
sensors are like really what make it compelling as a gaming platform.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, this is slightly different because with OnLive, you're not actually, you know, downloading and installing games mm-hmm. onto your
it's
machine.
It's run on a server.
Yeah, run on a server, and the graphics are streamed to you.
Yeah, that's a neat concept. There's a technology called PCOIP that allows you to do like high-speed graphics over an IP network. Basically, the host machine has like the heavy-duty processing cards,
right?
And then that's pumped out over Ethernet, gigabit usually, to a local box that then decodes that back into video and USB and keyboard mouse signals. But
right.
You know, so there's other. I've seen other uses of like this remote like processing and then streaming the video part of it, but I can't believe that it would yield the best in terms of a gaming experience. Like, you think there'd be too much delay? Like, the one thing about a game that's a native game, even when it's played over the network, is, yeah, you have network latency, but your movements locally immediately affect what you're seeing.
Right.
So there's got to be, you know, they got to send those commands up over the network, so there's going to be some delay until, and then has to, you know, send the video down.
Right, everything has to come back, so round trip.
Right.
Yeah, so that's, it's interesting. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting to see somebody, like you said, taking on Apple in the mobile gaming market. But we'll see how this works. Maybe HTC has found something that nobody else knew about in the streaming games. So there was an announcement from Sprint. I forget the tagline. Do you remember the tagline? Something that has never been done in the industry before?
No, it was just like some big announcement, an industry first.
Yeah, an industry first. And do you want to talk about this? Because you were the one who brought this to my attention.
Okay, yeah. So I guess the announcement that they had, it was a joint sort of announcement between Kyocera and, you know, I don't know if everyone remembers Kyocera. They used to make cell phones.
They used to make dumb phones.
Yeah. Dumb phones.
Compared to smartphones.
Yeah, it's like high-def TV. I have a friend that now calls everything else low-def. Yeah. Like, he was like the first one of my friends to get a HDTV, and he's like, I can't watch low-def TV anymore. Yeah. Not standard def or just like normal TV, right. low-def. So now, like, everything that's not a smartphone is a dumb phone.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. But anyway, I look at this thing and I have to laugh. It's like this dual screen, you know, it folds out like it, I don't know what the word is. Like, it doesn't fold actually. It sort of like slides and then like moves apart. Like, what's that called? Like telescoping, or I don't know.
It's not telescoping.
It's almost like a boom arm on a microphone sort of thing. Like unfolds.
It's not a fold like a book. The right. top half that would normally be the touch screen on an iPhone would slide and then tilt so that it shows another touch screen underneath it.
Right.
So it's kind of weird looking. It looks like a book when it's out and open, but, do you see a need for these dual screen phones like this?
Well, no. And this is why I think it's silly. Like, a lot of people have two screens on a device, on a computer, or maybe they have a laptop and they also have an external monitor connected to it. It's nice having the screen real estate, you know, to dump things
on. It really is.
But the thing that's awful is having that seam between the two displays. Like, I hate it. I hate, you know, and I remember looking at the Microsoft tablet when they announced that.
The Courier
it was called.
Yeah.
It was like a fold-out thing. It was a neat concept because it was more of like a tablet. But having the two screens, to me, just didn't seem necessary. It's like, I don't know. To me, one screen with another sort of like input device is what seems natural to me. Like, I'm surprised we haven't seen anyone like put thumb pads on devices or... Well, I guess the touchscreens sort of are, but like,
right.
you know, it's QWERTY keyboards make a lot of sense. Like, this form factor might really work for a QWERTY quote unquote slider where it kind of like folds open instead of slides.
Right.
Like, the mechanical part of it's neat, but I think having two screens, I don't know. It didn't interest me at all. I was like, lame.
Yeah. I mean, for them hyping this up an industry first, and then we see, oh, it's a phone with two screens. Like, really? So yeah, if you're interested in that, you know, there's an article on Wired.com in their Gadget Lab that talks about this new dual-screen Android smartphone. So give it a check out. Maybe it's something that interests you. But yeah, like Ryan, I have no interest in this this dual-screen flipper, movable, mechanical phone.
Lame.
I don't know. But do you have an update to a story we talked about last week?
Well, is this the... Yeah, okay, so... Well, this story wasn't really my original story, but there's a story from Bloomberg here that the Nokia stock has tumbled on concerns with over the concern of a partnership with Microsoft that it may kill the phone maker. But anyway, the big announcement is that the Nokia Microsoft partnership was true. It actually they announced
right.
it on Friday last week. It's a big deal. Basically, the new CEO, Stephen Elop, I think Elop.
Yeah, I say know. Elop.
Elop, who is a former Microsoft employee, he's now CEO of Nokia.
He
he basically decided that, hey, We've lost a lot of market share in the smartphone world.
Are you like that reporter who had a stroke on TV?
Yeah, I'm really losing it. Sorry. They've lost a lot of market share. They're down to like under 30%, where they used to be in the 50s, I think, globally. It looks like their smartphone market plunged to 27%. In the last quarter from a high of 50.8%.
Wow.
When Apple shipped its iPhone in 2007. So over those last couple years, about 4 years, it's really drained away their market share. I don't know that it's necessarily just because of Apple. I mean, I think RIM has made gains worldwide as well as Android. So there's other reasons for this huge fall.
Well, it's not so much that the other companies have made gains, it's that Nokia hasn't done anything.
Right.
In the past couple of years.
Well, they had this MeeGo platform. I mean, Symbian's been around a long time, and I guess MeeGo is like the new platform that like runs on top of Symbian.
I'm going to be honest, I had never heard of that before you just mentioned it.
Oh, wow. Well, so that's sort of what is like, I guess there's a lot of open source development that goes into this. It's spelled QT. I think it's pronounced cute.
Is that the Linux graphical?
Yeah, it's exactly, but that's what Symbian uses, I guess, is cute.
Okay, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and it's got a very like strong, you know, fervent following. The developers that work on it, the people that use it, they really, really like it. In fact, when this announcement came out of this partnership with Microsoft, and by the way, the partnership is that they will be using Windows Phone 7 on the majority and the best and most advanced Nokia smartphones. And so when this announcement came out, something like 5,000 of Nokia's employees walked out.
Wow.
That day. Now, it was not that they quit, and they actually used their flexible time policies that they have there in Finland or Sweden or wherever it is.
We're not quitting. We're not protesting. We're just walking away for a couple seconds.
But it was sort of like, you know, organized. What's the word? Like dissent, but like organized peaceful dissent, you know.
Right.
The concern here, I think the Bloomberg story is a little, especially the headline is very misleading, that the partnership with Microsoft may kill the phone maker. I think really, with any switch they would make, it's going to take a lot of time for any company to make a switch like this, to build the ecosystem around it. And during that time, when they're doing the development, building out the functionality, the ecosystem, that obviously they're probably going to continue to lose market share.
Yeah. And that whole thing is something that, you know, every company does at one point. You know, even Apple did it with the iPhone. The only difference here is that while Apple was doing all of that development work on the iPhone, they didn't have, a dog in the race. So people
didn't... Yeah, they had no market share.
Right. People didn't realize that Apple was making this phone, making these changes. Whereas Nokia, they already have a dog in the race. They've already made phones. People know they make phones. And now they're taking a step back, doing a 180, using a whole new operating system. And people were starting to take notice that it's like, oh, you're not doing phones for a while you make these new things? You know, so I think that's one of the big things here, is that people see it with Nokia, because they're in essence stopping business while they do this new partnership.
Yeah, I mean... Like in some ways, I wonder. I'm sure Apple isn't doing poorly, but I wonder if they've made up all the money that they lost on the initial investment. You know, because this was just total R&D for them.
Right. Yeah. They started up.
Yeah. New OS, which may have some very, very small resemblance to Mac OS at its very base, at least initially. Maybe, I don't even know.
Well, yeah, it's the same BSD core.
Yeah, like way down there, the kernel. But I mean. Other than, they had a lot more development to do. That said, just a couple points on Windows Phone 7. There was a lot of articles that came out about how Windows 7, you know, it's not going to be ready for prime time for Nokia because it's missing all these different features. There's a lot of, stories now about the new features that will be introduced into Windows Phone 7 in 2011, like multitasking, copy and paste, and IE9. These are all this is a fully HTML5 compliant browser. All this stuff's going to be rolled into Windows Phone 7 this year, with updates starting sometime in this late spring.
And I actually found that kind of funny. You know, everybody talked about when the iPhone came out, oh, it can't do copy and paste? Really? And then what was the other WebOS for the Palm Pre? Oh, when that came out, it can't do copy and paste either? Really? Haven't you learned from Apple? And now Windows Phone 7, oh, you guys haven't learned from WebOS and Apple?
Well, I think they did learn. I mean, with Apple, it took how many years to get it? We're going to get it in less than like 6 months.
Well, sure.
This phone.
But if they would have learned, I mean, these things happened in the past. I think if they would have learned, it would have been in reverse. Yeah, reverse. Revision one.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I see no problem with a company that's releasing a completely brand new thing. Like, it would be one thing. I mean, take Windows Mobile 6 and 6.5. They had copy and paste, okay? But the interface for them completely changed from there to Windows Phone 7. I mean, this was one was a keyboard and pen touched based interface, which it's very easy to do copy and paste with a pen. It's not so easy when you're using fingers and you have to do a lot of prediction and you know, make sense of it. So I think for Windows Phone 7 is being less of an evolutionary thing and more of a revolutionary thing for them, it makes sense for them to roll the features out one by one. I don't think it's going to hurt anyone.
I don't think it's going to hurt anything. I just thought it was kind of funny that they didn't. That one feature that everybody wanted.
I really don't think anyone would have complained about copy and paste as much as they would have with Apple had they not provided a way to get MMS messages without needing to type
go
in.
Go to a website.
Yeah, you had to type in. And I was actually looking for references about this online. It's really hard to find any about how the whole system worked. But from what I remember is that it would send you a link. And if you clicked the link, it'd take you to the website. But then you still had to type in this like ridiculously long password.
Username and password.
Okay, it was username. So But anyway, and the password wasn't one that you picked. It was something
neither
gave
was the
you.
Username.
Right.
They
so
were both random.
Completely random. And you had to somehow get them into this website without being able to copy and paste them. You know, it was ridiculous. So, I mean, that was the only really place you needed copy and paste in iOS version 1 and 2.
And you didn't have it.
So, and I think Microsoft is like sort of designed around that. Yeah, it doesn't have copy and paste, but it doesn't need it. Like,
right.
They've designed around it.
Right.
So, anyway, big news. They merged, or they've got a partnership, and I think all these new features coming in Windows Phone 7 are going to make this possibly a very big competitor.
I totally agree. And especially because of the next article that we have. Windows Phone 7 has already been jailbroken, you know, as has every phone operating system when it gets released. There are people dedicated to just jailbreaking phones. That's what they like to do. But here's the difference in how Microsoft handled it. Yes, they shut it down. They contacted these people. They said, hey, you know, take your jailbreaks off the website. But they didn't just say, take it down, we don't like you. They said, take it down, come into our office, we want to talk to you. So these guys were probably thinking, okay, we're going to walk into the Redmond office and there are going to be people in black suits and they're going to cuff us. But that's not what happened at all. They walked in and they actually got to talk with people on the Windows Phone 7 team. And, you know, they got to work with them so that Microsoft learned, you know, how they're doing it, you know, why they're doing it. And really, the reason a lot of people jailbreak their devices is so they can get software on it that they write themselves. You know, we talk about this with PlayStation 3, known as Homebrew. You write your own software, you put it on the device. So a lot of people, you know, if you want to get an application on your iPhone, you can't. You have to get it in the App Store, and then you have to buy it from the App Store. Same deal was going to be with Windows Phone 7. You couldn't write your own software for it. It had to get in the Windows Phone 7 App Store, and then you had to purchase it or for free, whatever, to get it on your device. These people wanted to write their own software. So now Microsoft is talking with these people who jailbroke the phone to figure out a way that they can open up the phone to people who want to write their own software while still maintaining the security of having an App Store that, I don't want to say authenticates, authorizes, what's the word I'm looking for? Verifies.
Yeah,
to make sure that people aren't just uploading viruses to their phones. So what do you think of this whole move by Microsoft?
Well, I think any time that you sort of crowdsource your content, feature knowledge, all that stuff, it's good. This is a sort of a form of crowdsourcing. They're saying, okay, there's people out there doing this. Let's embrace what they're doing, roll it in, and you know, support their efforts. Because I think, like, for example, when you have a problem with Windows, there's, you know, you can search Google, Microsoft has their knowledge base, but like a lot of times you find answers in forums. Like, I think more companies, I think some companies are do this, but Microsoft maybe hasn't been always been the greatest in embracing the community. But, you know, this is a really good example for everyone else of how to do it.
I totally agree.
I think it's great.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to other companies allowing homebrew, you know, while still making sure people don't upload viruses to the App Store and get bad software on their phones. So plus one for Microsoft.
Yeah. One other final point too is I think Microsoft's finally realized, you know, that nothing they offer doesn't have competition in the open source world. You know, they like all of their major products have pretty hefty competition. I still think Microsoft makes best in class of a lot of products, you know, software products, but they have competition. So if they close off the outside world, they're going to hurt themselves. And embracing people doesn't hurt them because there's nothing, you know, it's not going to be like proprietary things that get handed out the door. You know, like
right.
they can still protect their proprietary, their very strategic intellectual property. I'd say probably more what would be dangerous is like, you know, their vision, their plan for the future, all this other stuff. Like, you know, that would be more detrimental than like how the freaking software works.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. So this is definitely a good move for Microsoft. I'm looking forward to what they decide. I'm looking forward to see when they roll out these features, you know, in what version of Windows Phone 7 or maybe Windows Phone 8. You know, who knows when the features are going to come out to allow homebrew, but I'll be interested to see how they do it. So I believe you have a BlackBerry story for us.
Yeah. So from crackberry.com, there was some pictures of the BlackBerry Playbook in the Office Depot like inventory software, and they're pricing it. They had a price tag there for the 16 gigabyte Wi-Fi version of $499. So do you think it's acceptable price wise? Too much for a Wi-Fi version?
No, I think that is right in line with the iPad.
Yeah.
For a 16 gig iPad with Wi-Fi only. And this is interesting because, you know, this goes against what we saw on Sprint's website and all the articles a month ago or so that you had to buy 3G service with the Playbook. This is showing that you probably don't.
Yeah, actually, from what I've saw elsewhere too, is that I don't think they're going to offer a 3G version.
See, that is so weird.
Yeah, like they're saying that, like at least from the BlackBerry website, that there'll be two different Wi-Fi versions, like I think different sizes memory wise, and then there's a 4G version, but I didn't see it said, or you can tether it with your 3G phone. Like that was the way you get 3G access.
Yeah. They must've completely taken a 180.
Yeah.
If you remember from a couple of weeks ago, the Sprint website, you know, showed you could only buy it from Sprint and you had to buy a plan with it.
Yeah.
And now it's available in freaking Office Depot.
Now, I personally was hoping to see somewhat of a lesser price point. I was like thinking like $399 would be awesome, or like even like
I would have loved that,
like $349, something like that. Because, yeah, it has the camera, but this is still basically equivalent to the $499 iPad, so it's not a lot cheaper. It's got a camera, it's dual core processor, it can probably do some heftier processing than the iPad can, but it's a smaller screen.
And here's the kicker. In a couple weeks, you know, if rumors are correct, we're probably going to see the iPad 2.
Right.
And the iPad 2 is probably going to come out at the exact same price point as the iPad 1.
Right.
And which will make the iPad 1 cheaper.
Yeah.
Probably like $300. So now you're going to have a $300 competitor to the $500 Playbook.
Right. Well, minus the camera.
Minus the camera. Right.
But, and yeah, and less screen real estate, or more screen real estate on the iPad. So I don't know. It may work. I think it's the, you know, this tablet market is still wide open. There's a lot of room, and I think people are going to have to, the company's going to have to try to figure out where their product settles into the price structure. And
right. Yeah. Apple has hit a home run in the tablet market. They have not by any means hit a grand slam.
Right.
There is still room for somebody else to come in.
They haven't won the game. They've won a battle.
They've won a battle. They have not won the war.
Right.
Nice. Love bringing in other quotes. So, Ryan, are you Catholic?
Yes.
So you're familiar with the concept, not the concept, the sacrament of reconciliation.
Yes,
most people know going to confession.
Yes.
So there was some big hoopla about a new iPhone application called Confession, a Roman Catholic app. It's $1.99 in the iTunes store. I bought it because I wanted to see what this thing did. You know, after hearing all the hoopla about it, I wanted to see what it was. And we have a video here from ABC News where a priest talks about this app. It's only 2 minutes long, so let's hear what he has to say before we go into our own commentary on it.
Hi, this is A Moment of Faith. I'm Father Edward Beck in New York. So when was the last time you went to confession? I'm speaking mostly, of course, to the Catholics here. And yeah, I know for many of you, it's been a while. And believe me, I've heard all of the excuses. You know, I forget the prayers. I don't know the act of contrition. I can't remember any of my sins. I don't think I should have to tell my sins to a man, except if he's the big man. And even this one, I still have nightmares from the last time I got yelled at and thrown out. That was my mother's, by the way. Well, now our ever-evolving technology wants to help. By now you've heard that there's a new confession app that's been developed for those of you lucky enough to pocket an iPhone, and even the Pope seems to be approving this one. It leads you through an examination of conscience for those of you who can't figure out what your sins are, and it's even age-appropriate. So say if you're a 14-year-old boy and you log in, a question under the sixth commandment is, do I treat my body and others with purity and respect? And if you sign in as a 40-year-old married man, that commandment asks you, have you masturbated recently? Yeah, so this app also guides you through the confession format and prayers so that you won't get all tongue-tied and amnesic while sweating before the collared absolver. But sweat you must. Even with the app, yes, you still need to visit one like me to get the official church absolution. But now there's a way for you to edit your first draft on your little iPhone before having to deliver it orally. I really seriously hope this makes approaching the sacrament more appealing. I can attest from both sides of the screen that confession remains a powerful venue of grace and healing. So I'm all for whatever makes it easier for people to take that plunge. Just make sure you tell the priest that you're using the app and not texting or surfing the web during your confession. I wouldn't want you getting thrown out of the box your first time back.
Yeah, so now that you've heard an actual priest describe this, I just want to reiterate a point, which is the whole hoopla about this application. People thought, holy crap, I can go to confession on my phone? I don't actually have to go to a church and talk to a priest? This is awesome.
I can phone it in.
And the Vatican approved this? This is amazing. But that was just the news media, you know, running wild with this application. You know, as the priest there said, you can't confess via the phone. You still have to confess with a priest. But now you have something to help you because, I mean, I'm guilty of it too. You go into the confessional, your mind goes blank. Or you just don't know what to think of. You know, what have I done that is wrong? And now you have an app to help you with that. Would you consider using something like this?
I think it's a little weird, honestly. I mean, I don't know. I don't get it. I mean, I guess if it helps people, fine. But I don't get it.
Yeah, I thought it was very funny that anybody thought that you could phone in a confession.
Wow.
Like, really, I'm just going to email in, I stole this pack of gum, and the Pope is going to email me back, hey, you're good. Seriously? Like, who thought that?
Yeah.
Okay, so anyways, moving on. So AT&T has been trying multiple things to get people to not switch to Verizon. We had an article last week that Ryan submitted where they were giving out free microcells to people. I didn't get an email about that, so I haven't gotten one yet. Yeah. But another thing they're doing is giving 1,000 minutes for free, 1,000 bonus rollover minutes. Now, I did not get the text message that said, hey, you can get this. Just text yes to this number.
They probably lost the text message.
Probably.
Transmission.
But I did see that other people got this, so I just, out of the blue, texted this number with the word yes, and I got my 1,000 minutes.
Oh, that's kind of neat.
Yeah. So anybody on AT&T, if you text the word yes to 11113020, you will get 1,000 bonus rollover minutes.
What do you think would happen if I texted that number?
Do it. Well, are short codes the same on multiple carriers? Because I know, like, whenever you're like voting on American Idol or something, they say you can only do it if you're AT&T or you can only do it if you're Verizon.
I don't know.
So this is probably only a number that works on AT&T.
Yeah, I don't know. 40404 works on everything. Right?
That's true. Twitter works on everything.
They probably pay for that number, though.
I would imagine they do.
Yeah.
But I don't want to talk too much about this, but what do you think of all these things that AT&T are trying to do to make people not switch?
Honestly, this is not going to get... I don't think it's going to get anyone to stay. I mean, there was just an article on Reddit a couple days ago. Somebody, I think they may have linked to this article or maybe heard this was happening. And they're like, hey, AT&T, you don't get it. Like, I have like 3,000 rollover minutes on my account right now. I want a cheaper plan. Like, I can't... Right.
I don't need the minutes.
Right, exactly. I mean... I don't use all my minutes. I don't think I've even come close in like several years. So I'd say nice try, but not going to save you.
Exactly. Yeah. I have so many rollover minutes. I've begun to lose them. I tried so many different tenses in that sentence. I don't know what was going on, but maybe something that would keep people on AT&T is if they happen to have cheaper and smaller iPhones.
Yeah. In addition to what I recently saw, they're offering the iPhone 3GS at like $49.
Yeah, now. $50.
$50 for that phone. There's some rumors that Apple may be working on smaller iPhones, like maybe slightly less capable versions, at a lower price point. My guess is they're probably doing that because the manufacturing for the 3GS will probably be, you know, mothballed eventually.
Right.
It probably only has a certain amount of shelf life to it. And, you know, they're thinking about coming out with also a dual mode phone, you know, that runs in CDMA and GSM.
Well, while you mention that, let's just talk about our next article as well. And that is that the current Verizon iPhone 4 is a dual phone. The chipset in that phone is capable of CDMA and GSM. They just disabled the GSM part. So that it only works on Verizon. So, you know, the guys at iFixit, I believe, were the ones who figured this out when they tore the phone apart.
Yeah, to be quite honest, it wouldn't surprise me because, you know, there's a ton of BlackBerry phones out there that are world capable.
Right, like it's the Qualcomm chipset.
Yeah, you know? Storm 2, the Tour, the Bold 9650, the 8830. You know, there's a ton of world phones that have come out over the years.
Yep, so the Verizon iPhone 4 is one of those. It's just been disabled. So we can pretty much assume with 100% certainty that when the iPhone 5 comes out, they will use the same chipset and it will be a universal phone.
Yeah. The other thing I read, and I don't know if your article about the universal phones mentioned, is that they're trying to do away with that with SIM cards going to those.
They're trying to go to software SIM.
Yeah, and I think this is all in their like plan to be able to manage these phones better and allow them to, you know, go from network to network.
Yeah, let's make one thing clear, though. Software SIM is only good for the company. It's not good for the user.
Yeah.
Because it ties you to a carrier.
Oh,
because you
yeah.
can't, quote-unquote, change the SIM if you want to go to a different carrier because it's in the freaking phone.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting. Well, I guess they would, but they could still SIM lock you anyways with the phone.
Yeah, they could.
It really doesn't.
Yeah, and to go back to your article about the smaller, cheaper phone, the joke around the internet is the iPhone Shuffle, where it only has one button. You press the button, and it randomly calls one of your contacts. You don't know which one because there's no screen.
You know, or it's like totally voice actuated or something. Like you press it and just. But I mean, without a screen, the iPhone loses a lot of appeal.
Right. It's not an iPhone without the screen.
Yeah.
So we'll see what happens with that. But sticking with the iPhone, something that is interesting that you may not have known is that when you if you were to lose your iPhone, even if you have it password protected, people can still get your data off within 6 minutes. And there is a video on techworld.com.au that shows how this happened. And we can't play you the video because the people don't explain anything. It's a no sound video. But basically, the person plugs in the cable to their computer, shuts off the phone, turns on the phone with their program running on their computer. The program catches the phone in the middle of the boot, jailbreaks it, and is able to read the file system.
Wow.
And you see on the screen just a raw data dump, which is actually all of these stored passwords and any saved data that you have on your phone. And they actually, you know, they blurred out so that they didn't give away their own passwords. But yeah, within 6 minutes. So sure, password protect your phone so people like us can't get access to it. But if you lose your phone and somebody wants your data, that's not going to help. This goes back to our story from last week or the week before, encrypt your phone.
Yeah.
You know, that's really the only way to get around that. And have you ever, I don't know about this, do BlackBerries allow in-app purchases?
If they do, I don't really know a lot about it and I've never used it.
Okay, so people who use the iPhone may or may not have seen this because it's not in every application. It's mostly in games. But you pay or you don't pay for the game. Let's just say it's called Smurfs Village. It's a game about the Smurfs. Everybody loves the Smurfs. But inside of that game, if you want extra features, extra toys, extra berries in this case, you can buy them in the game and it will initiate a purchase to the iTunes App Store and you physically have to pay for what you're buying in the game. Well, problem with that, and that a lot of people have been seeing, is that once you enter your password one time, it remembers it for like the next 15 minutes. So you enter your password, you buy your one-year-old, two-year-old, whatever, the Smurfs game, give your phone to them, they start playing it, all of a sudden, hey, do you want more berries? Press yes to buy. Yes. Do you want this? Press yes. Yes.
Yes.
So this one person's kid racked up $1,400 in-app purchases. It was an 8-year-old, so it wasn't even a 1 or 2-year-old who didn't know what was going on. It was an 8-year-old who just kept clicking yes, buy. Probably didn't even realize that it was real money. Probably thought it was just part of the game. But this brings up a problem we talked about before of, you know, remembering the passwords for the iTunes App Store or for any app store and not making you input it for every purchase. Do you have any suggestions? I mean, if you were to try to fix this, you know, what would you do to make this not happen again?
Yeah, I don't know. Honestly, sometimes I like the convenience of not having to enter in a password again, but I'd say just make it so that you have to enter the password every time. Any transaction should require some kind of authorization, just like a credit card.
Like any in-app transaction? Or would you do it for the whole system in that any transaction in the app or in the app store at all? Like every time you go to get a new app, enter the password?
Yeah, probably. That'd probably be the best.
Yeah, that's what I would think too. I mean, I thought that it might work, at least for in-app purchases, where it would at least pop up a window and say, you know, are you sure? You know, do you know this is going to charge your credit card? But in the case of this story, you know, from Two Owl, the 8-year-old is going to see that and say, oh, who cares? Click yes. So the are you sure box is only going to work for people like us who would see it, read it, realize this is money out of our pockets. But not going to work so much for kids. So I would actually expect to see Apple put out some sort of update that forces, you know, a password every time or at least multiple levels of are you sure before you start buying things. So anything else that you saw interesting happen around the tech sphere this week?
Actually, today, just a couple quick things. There's a... some rumors floating around that AMD may be sold to Dell.
I saw that.
Yeah.
What in the world?
That's pretty crazy.
Can you think of any reason?
Well, I don't know that AMD's in the best of shape right now.
Oh, they're clearly not.
You know,
but they are NVIDIA. You know?
What's that?
NVIDIA, the graphics company. It's AMD.
No, you're thinking ATI.
Oh, no, it's AMD, right?
AMD and ATI merged.
Oh, okay, sorry. Sorry.
Yeah. So it's like... So, I mean, like, AMD being, like, one of the... Did I say NVIDIA?
I said NVIDIA. Oh, okay. I knew it was a video card company. I forgot which one.
Yeah. Well, I mean, AMD, I mean, they still make a lot of desktop processors, and it's some share of Dell's, you know, desktop processor market, and maybe even laptops and stuff. But I think like there were some rumors saying, hey, maybe they're going to go through the Apple model and like build integrated systems. But
I can see that because they have moved toward their studio lineup. They've been making a lot of all-in-one systems or, you know, very small systems.
Yeah, I mean, laptops are kind of all-in-one. They, you know, they've been doing that for a long time. But even you know, Apple has given up on the custom microprocessor, you know, for their, except for, you know, they do make the A4 for the iPhone and the iPad, but I think that's more about like battery life and everything else.
Right.
Where with like the MacBooks and stuff and the desktop machines, they use Intel processors. So right. Why Dell would want to do that, I don't know. I mean, I know.
Well, it's still x86. You know, it's not proprietary.
Yeah, but I have to really wonder like why they would want to buy it. I feel bad for AMD. Like, you know, they went from being like king of the heap there for several years when the Athlon came out.
Right. The Athlon XP, that was the king.
Yeah. Well, I mean, even the first Athlon, it was crushing what Microsoft or what Intel had released. And throughout the whole Pentium 4 era, I mean, the Pentium 4s were awful.
Yeah, those were horrible.
You know, that whole AMD kind of like saved it. You know, they saved the day. They had something out there that was usable, and I still have a few AMD machines at home.
Yeah, my college machine was a dual Athlon MP system.
Oh, nice. Like on an A-bit board?
Yeah.
Yeah, the old A-bit AE6.
Actually, it might have been Asus. I don't know. There was only one manufacturer that made a board for dual Athlon MPs.
That wasn't like server class.
Yeah. I don't know who. It was either A-bit or Asus.
Probably A-bit. It would have been like the A6E or something. But yeah, you know, that I don't know. I have a real fond spot in my heart for AMD. I'd hate to see them get bought out. I really hope they could make another run at Intel. Although the desktop, you know what? Maybe what AMD really should start looking is embedded stuff. You know, like in the mobile market, they have a lot of embedded history. The AMD 29K. They've got a lot of stuff that, you know, runs aircraft.
And, well, they do. But whenever you're up against a company like ARM,
yeah,
like nobody's gonna win. You know, it's going to take an Apple to come along out of nowhere, never done a processor before, no
but I mean,
backstory.
But all ARM is doing is that they're just designing the thing. Like, they're not building it. You know, TI and what's the other one? TI and Motorola, they all build the chips. You know,
right, so ARM is just the spec.
Right.
But still, you know, whenever you have that to go up against, it's going to be hard for anybody to take
them off. Were saying, you know, maybe they should just license ARM, you know, and embrace and extend.
Like, that's true. Yeah, be another Motorola or TI and make an ARM processor.
Yeah. So anyways, those are just one of the stories I saw.
All right. So I have nothing else. That is everything for this week's edition of the Slongcast. As usual, you can find me on Facebook and Twitter. My username is Slongcack. Ryan, people want to find you.
I am also on Facebook and Twitter at @RyanLancey. And you can also find me on my blog. It's Lancipedia. .blogspot.com.
Very cool. Definitely check out the Lancipedia. It's like Wikipedia, but better.
Yeah.
So if you want us to talk about a story, I noticed this week we had a lot more submissions from not us. So that was definitely good that we got some viewers submitting stories this week. Definitely love that. So next week's episode will be the episode 24. So just tag an article on Delicious, Slongcast024, and we will make sure to talk about it for you. But other than that, I hope you guys all have a wonderful Tuesday evening.